Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes.
The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports.
Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact on success. I'm Jeremy Piasecki, the Executive Director of Culture and Sports.
And I'm Sydney Moore, a former Division I volleyball player and CEO of Thrive Insights, a sports consulting firm. Please join us for Season 6 of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
We have an incredible guest today, Bob Boland. Bob, why don't you say hi to our audience and introduce yourself?
Hi, everybody. I'm Bob Boland. Couple things about the topic and the place we are. I had the weirdest job in college athletics for 5 years as the athletics integrity officer at Penn State, overseeing a $200 million athletic department at a time when legalized sports betting was coming, at a time when NIL was coming, and at a time when basically college athletics was on fire. So I left that job in 2022. I'm a law professor at Seton Hall University, where I'm writing a book on NIL. I helped write the first NIL law that went into law in this country, and it is a particularly meaningful topic to me because it is the culmination of a long journey for college athletes. And I did the largest high school NIL deal in history, at least till next year, when it gets eclipsed, but an $800,000 deal for the institution that brought the athlete there. And then I have worked and advised about 30 athletic directors and coaches all around this topic, because it's a hot topic for all of them to have. And I don't know if there's a more pertinent topic, and particularly a complex one, because I think most people see it only through one lens or another and not through what it holistically can be.
And before we get into that with you, Bob, Sydney, can you share a little bit about your own experience and what exactly NIL meant for you, both as a collegiate athlete, which you just currently finished that phase in your life, and moving on to being a professional athlete?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about it all the time, like on Season 6 so far, about how my NIL experience has been a little bit different than the others. Mine started as a requirement to be able to be an intern for a company that I was helping start found. And that company was really all around advocacy, but we did have corporate partnerships and we did, you know, make money. And so I had to state that as an NIL deal. So the first 2.5 to 3 years of NIL, I was a sophomore up until my junior, senior year at Cornell. And everything I was doing was really related to speaking engagements, going and talking to different people, and doing kind of just my fulfilling my duties as a worker at a company when they would work with brands. But because I was a student athlete, I had to tell my school about those deals and I had to follow those rules. And so for me, NIL was always a little bit of a frustration thing at first, of like, hey, any other student at Cornell could work with a company, could intern at Google or whatever, and do corporate partnerships and post about the corporate partnership they did online, whether they were making money or not, and it would be fine. Why can't I use the fact that I'm a Cornell student athlete, that I'm a psychology student, I'm a neuroscience student, to get more attention towards this thing that I'm building? Like, why can't I do that? And so that was kind of like the original frustration, literally even the fact that I couldn't use the trademark of Cornell. It wasn't, you know, something where we were making like a lot of money or where we were necessarily using Cornell's likeness for the sake of building, but hey, that's a part of my identity, right? Like I own that part too. So as it changed going into, you know, my podcast, which you guys all know about, and now NIL for me has really just been a way to build my personal brand. In a lot of ways, it was really just another piece of red tape that I had to do to build my own business. So my NIL thing has been a little bit different than most. I don't really do a lot of endorsement deals. I'm not really posting day in the life videos or anything like that where there's companies that really want to send me their product, but more that the fact that I was a student athlete was a barrier in what any other person who was running a business could do.
Now, Sydney, do you think that
any of the work you've currently done, not only for yourself, but in your podcast and helping other athletes, you know, do you feel that you've definitely been helping other athletes? Do you definitely think that there's a pathway for athletes, or do you think it's like the Wild West out there still, and everyone has their two cents to throw in and thinks they're the expert in NIL?
I definitely still think it's a Wild West. If we look to the history of professional sports leagues, if we just look to the institutions of sports that are very profitable, we're very early on in the process of what it might take to have, you know, a system. But also those things are constantly changing, right? So I do think that there's a lot of people coming into this space that don't know a lot about it. But let's also be honest, even if you have been, you know, of a sports professional for years and years and years, there is still aspects to this change in college sports right now that everyone's a newbie to. And yeah, I'll leave it there. I know, Bob, you had something to say.
No, I think Sydney hit on one of the problems that college athletes experienced with NIL being made legal or permitted for athletes after, you know, 170 odd years of being denied, is that they were last to the table.
Yeah.
Oh, you can't use Ralph Lauren's polo player, even though you own the shirt. Oh, that's his intellectual property. Oh, I can't use Cornell. No, that's Cornell's intellectual property. And it was a big piece of frustration for athletes to figure out and begin to define their space, I think, in this area. And then I think the schools made it even harder for them by coming up with collectives and sort of a substitute for salary. The great part about NIL in theory, and the great part about NIL in practice, is it gives athletes a chance to invest in themselves and understand themselves as a commodity in a way that others would, but also in something that is saleable and skill-driven. I think it also allowed athletes to invest in their education. And I mean, I think one of the great ironies is the NCAA is now spending tens of millions of dollars denying eligibility to people who've used a fourth or a fifth year. So it kind of denying the whole marketplace. So NIL was created at night and in the dark and undercover, and it was given to the athletes not because it was a solution per se, but because it was low-hanging fruit that they deserved and long deserved. So the idea that we are finding our way through it is such a common factor, and the fact that it's changed dramatically or changing dramatically right now at year three is even a bigger iteration. So I think it's complicated. I'm unabashedly still in favor of NIL because people like Sydney are having opportunities around it. And if nothing else, let's say Sydney is going to do what a lot of other Ivy League athletes do, which is go to a career in something other than sports. Or maybe she'll do it in sports in a career that didn't involve her being a player. But the idea that she's learned these things through the observation of this process, she's learned how to sell herself to prospective buyers. These are going to be things that are almost impractical, and it's going to close the opportunity gap that she suffers to non-athletes. So who are out doing internships or other things. So the idea that we and I'm one of the people that has helped perseverate a system in college sports around NIL have misunderstood this, were afraid of it, denied it, and now have misunderstood it is really a great crisis. And I will say the one thing in my role, even though I was in a role where implementing NIL policy was part of my job, the place where we messed up worse was over-education. We did not educate the people as to what was possible, what the value proposition was. We tried to make it a one-size-fits-all and saw it only through recruitment or victory. And that's really not, that really is sort of a cheapening of it.
Yeah, I like what you're saying. One frustration that I'll add to my experience with NIL, just being more specific, was the perspective that my whole identity is related to me being an athlete. And so anything that I did that I could make money off of, any situation in which the fact that I was a student athlete, which is a core part of my personality, now was something that needed to be documented. And now with NIL Go, approved. Right? So
or the case of NIL Go, not approved, right?
Or not approved. I can't go do that. What do you mean? Like, right? So that's interesting, right? So And I even think now, right? So now, if I could go, let's say I had all my same experience, but I had more years of eligibility. I don't have tens of thousands of followers, but I have a high hourly rate for the work that I do because I've won an ESPY. I was Glamour Woman of the Year. I've done these different things. So if someone asks me to do an appearance and it's someone that's somewhat related to my school, that rate could come up to, and I'll go, volleyball player would never make this much money. This is pay for play. This isn't right. It's interesting. Like, how do we balance that? And how do we determine like these market values and different things, even if it's unrelated? It could be me going to speak at something totally unrelated to sports, a women's leadership conference, a different thing. But I have to state to my university and possibly risk, well, my school wouldn't say no, but I have to risk being told no for an opportunity that isn't necessarily related to me playing, because my identity, because I'm tied to this university, my whole identity is now controlled by the system. Like, that was something that was very frustrating to me, or that was the perspective of it for myself, because I think I had so many things outside of college athletics. I'm not sure that that's the case for all athletes, but that was definitely a frustrating piece for me. And that's also a lot of the messaging around NIL and for athletes creating a personal brand. The main thing that we hear athletes say, if you want to take advantage of NIL, it's get a TikTok account, get an Instagram account, commodify your life and who you are, and figure out who your values are at 18 years old, determine what your brand is and what everyone's going to remind you of, and post like that 3 times a day and come up with these ideas. And essentially it's commodifying your life. And you learn a lot of skills through that. And there's lots of other ways that athletes are encouraged to make money, but that's the main one. And that's concerning for me. It took me 3 years to get comfortable posting consistently on Instagram because I didn't feel comfortable coming up with brand pillars because I didn't have personal Sydney pillars.
Yeah, that's something great to think about. Now, Bob, being on both sides, being the athletic integrity officer at Penn State, and then also supporting athletes in different ways with regard to NIL and just eligibility and things like that, where do you see situations for athletes? Do you think that athletes do have fair equity in this, or do you think that it is still definitely controlled by the NCAA?
I don't know if it's controlled by the NCAA as much as it once was, but I do think that there are concerns that schools, entities have manipulated it to their benefit and not necessarily shown the athletes or talked to the athletes in a way that would be unique to them. So let's pull apart some of Sydney's things that she talked about. I bet she has a teammate who would love to just basically teach volleyball, to give volleyball lessons to high school and junior high kids and make 40 or 30 bucks an hour doing that. And that would give that young woman an opportunity to have some spending money. Probably she won't break the bank, but it might put her along the lines to a coaching career a little more quickly, or make her decide whether a coaching career is what she really wants. So those are things that came in with NIL, the idea that you can now give lessons, that you could take advantage of things. Some people might want to endorse a shoe deal or be a spokesperson for a product, or ultimately sell a product, which would be, or design the marketing plan for a product. NIL provides a lot of variety, but it didn't provide us with a lot of opportunity to talk about what's unique and authentic to each athlete and how they pursue that. And some people may be just majoring in engineering and don't want any of this crap. They just want to do their problem sets and play their sport and love it. And that's fine. This is the good part of what NIL opens the door for. Before, it was all forbidden. Now it's open. One of the problems I think we've come up with is that when we use it as a substitute for salary, the idea it's a surrogate for pay to play, and I don't like to even use those terms because they're all kind of silly. But when we looked at it as a recruiting angle and a substitute for salary to keep players on a certain campus or off a certain campus, I think it really lost the script in a way, because if we just gave people money, they weren't doing anything. It wasn't bettering them. And I think I'll make a broad generalization. women athletes like Sydney were fighting for opportunities and a way to earn that money, even though it wasn't a lot. And male athletes in football and men's basketball particularly were just queuing up to take their check. And they weren't getting anything, they weren't doing anything for it. They weren't changing their position. They weren't growing. So we had two different systems operating simultaneously side by side, not necessarily improving the institution, not necessarily telling the story of the institution, and or telling the story of the athlete and connecting in a unique way. I've done a lot of work in athlete transition post-professional career. As a scholar, that was always one of the things that I was very interested in, because we see it's happening in such broad terms in football or football mostly because of the injury factor and the CTE factor that comes with it. But it's really a transition. Do you have an aspiration to move to? Do you know what you're going to do? And one of the things we see in sports like tennis and golf, lifetime sports, if you will, players can kind of seamlessly move into those other roles afterwards. Roger Federer is probably a more highly paid endorser right now than he ever was as an active player. Now, not everybody's Roger Federer, and it would be great if you could be, but at the same time, wouldn't you want to explore how you become a lifelong endorser? How do you begin to grow in your sport? And I'll never forget a student of mine back at NYU, before there was a thing like NIL, was the gymnast Nastia Liukin. And Nastia changed agents as she was finishing her career to move to one that was a broadcast and fashion-oriented agent from an athlete representation agent. And I mean, it opens the door to who's your advisor, what does your advisor doing for you? Are they putting you in one-size-fits-all opportunities? Are they tailoring a program for you? But I don't think anybody's really thought about that. I think we're all just catching this as it comes, like on a rebound, and we're trying to make the best of it. And one of the challenges is nobody has reached out, maybe this group is doing it, in a thoughtful way to athletes, to parents, to people like me who advise in this space. What does this mean for you? What are you getting from it? Why do I do this? How do I connect with brands that build me? How do I do those things? And I'll throw two little stories into this. Kind of my two personal favorites of agents. Kind of the two most famous agents ever are a guy named Mark McCormick. McCormick is dead now, but the company he founded, IMG, is now part of CAA, and it's still the gold standard for representation. McCormick was a lawyer in a Cleveland firm doing business work when a golfer from Latrobe, Pennsylvania named Arnold Palmer walked through his door. And together, young lawyer, young golfer, they changed the world of this business together. And Donald Dell is another guy who kept taking Arthur Ashe, the tennis player, to meet with McCormick. And finally, after their third meeting, Ashe says to Donald Dell, who just graduated from Yale Law School and was the Davis Cup captain, he said, "Hey, Donald, why don't you just represent me?" And Ashe and Palmer are both gone. Dell's alive, tells the story all the time. But if you can have a long relationship with a brand, with partners, take the long view of this thing, you're almost always going to end up better. And even if your play doesn't turn out like Arthur Ashe or Arnold Palmer, the opportunity to have those are because you found unique people that valued you as an individual and not you as a commodity.
I do have a question for you. Sydney and I have talked a few times, and she's brought this up. Athletes weren't granted NIL rights. They had to fight for them. And this is probably part of a better question within collegiate sports in general. Are athletes truly equitable stakeholders, whether it's an NIL or just their rights as athletes, or do you think that still has a very long way to go?
Oh, I think it has a long way to go. I think it has a very, very long way to go. And unfortunately, if I were thinking about the House settlement and the mood of the NCAA and leadership, is they want to put athletes back into the bag in a way, take rights away that they've earned at really hard, hard-won sufferance. take away the rights to antitrust lawsuits, take away the right to challenge the NCAA, even limit the right to transfer, which I think Sydney and I would probably agree that most athletes probably shouldn't transfer a whole lot, because being a freshman at a bunch of different institutions that can't add up to a degree isn't helpful. But the idea that you can get out of a bad situation where there's coaching abuse, where there's an assaultive behavior, where there's just bad treatment for a better one, it should be a right that athletes have won and earned. So I think NIL is just really the easiest and kind of no skin off the nose of the NCAA view. And I think that, like, the Empire striking back, they're going to come back for some more of it, even while giving some of the top players more money as part of that. Because money isn't, I guess the answer here for me is, having studied in sports, having worked in sports, more money is not always the answer, because it's never going to be enough. The problem of all sports is that we invert the earnings curve. We give you the most of your money when you're young, and then you have to live off of it for a long, long time, as opposed to the rest of us who are, like, still going up the earnings curve, hopefully,
except for Bobby Bonilla.
Bobby Bonilla was smart enough to try to flatten the earnings curve, right? Every year till he's 65, he's going to get $1 million. And my God, that's going to probably mean the world to him, because he's probably not having to spend the money that he saved from playing. So, but guaranteed contracts, exceptional opportunities, degrees, more degrees. These are all levelers that athletes could be fighting for. And I think one of the things that NIL has sort of changed the focus, it's only been on the money. And maybe that's just how America is. It's always, tell me the money. And, you know, I've been an agent. I've represented people. I'll tell you about my first $1 million deal. It was $300,000 plus contracts that added up to $1 million. The player got cut in training camp. He never saw anything but $3,000 of that. But it's still my first $1 million contract. We always overstate things. It's subtle garbage. Anyway, I don't think athletes have fully won the equity that they deserve. And I think it will take some thought on how they get there in the future, as it's clear now schools, institutions are trying to cut them off from those avenues.
I like what you've said. I feel like, in my view, a lot of what's happening is could have been avoided. I think a lot of the outrage and the quickness of NIL, although I know people were talking about it for years in the background, but all of these changes in the house settlement, and, you know, all these cases with NLRB, like all of these different things, I really feel like are athletes at their wit's end for their needs getting met. And the realization, just like any other strike or anything that we've seen, when people's needs are continuously not met, at that point, they almost have nothing to lose. And so... I look back, it's like, it's not about, we see you guys making millions of dollars and we're not making any money. It's, we see you making millions of dollars and I'm reusing KTT. That is my frustration. It's not, oh, you know, I don't want this person to make this money, or I don't want the school to have this new dome, or all these different things. It's, if I'm providing the resources for you, there's a social contract that I believe we have together that you should provide for me. And so that is, like, one of the biggest things that I actually say for women athletes now that the house element has passed, and for non-revenue sports, is, guys, do not waste your breath trying to get your 1% separate, like, divided by 100 athletes of $20 million. Let's focus on making sure the school is going to have stocked athletic training facilities, that we're each going to have our own athletic trainer, that all of our teams are going to have an SID, that they're not going to take sandwiches out of the grab-and-go station. I'd rather sacrifice my little $10,000 that I would make split between all of us and not have to pay for those things out of my own pocket and not have it taxed than get this, like, max $5,000. Like, if there weren't, if, you know, like, if the Fab Five and all these teams weren't walking to practice every day, there wouldn't be these crazy articles and different things. Of this outrage. Eventually, yes, we would get to a point where people are asking for money. If you look at the history of every professional league ever, of course, that's going to happen. But I don't think we would have this quick, you know, band-aid and fighting and all of this that we see now. I think that's really where athletes are coming from. It's frustration. I mean, even as an athlete at Syracuse, I love my school, but there's things that happen in the athletic department that makes me not want to wear, you know, post that I went there and do different things. Cause I'm like, how are you going to make this decision and have us living like this? It's just, it's annoying.
And if you reduce the only benefit to being money, then it's only going to be the money and it will never be enough, right? It's the problem of that. It's the other things. What makes the NCAA has lost the script on that, or lost the plot on that over the years. And I think that's one of the challenges. And people in this role have lost the plot often, that it's the transformative power of the education, the experience, the time that you put in on campus that can really change your life. And I think that's an important piece of it. So I tell everybody, I don't know anybody who's received life-changing NIL money.
Yeah.
And somebody immediately will point out, well, the quarterback at Michigan is getting $10 million over 4 years. And my answer is, talk to me after he's gotten it. Tell me what he really receives and how he gets it and what's in the bonus. Tell me about how this works. And certainly, if you can make $1 million or $250,000 or $500,000 as a young person, that can have an alteration to the trajectory of your life. But it may not be as important as your educational benefits, making sure your health and welfare is being taken care of at a high level, and dealing with this. So I'm not for putting the genie back in the bottle by any stretch of the imagination. I don't want throwing a small sum of money at people to be the recompense for what athletes deserve in this setting and what the work that their labor provides back to the institution. Sydney, were you ever not an advertisement for Cornell Athletics?
No.
Every time you went to practice, hosted a recruit, talked about your experience, took a class, got a good grade, took a class, got a passing grade, didn't matter. You were always representing that department, and that department will never be separated much from you. Yeah.
Cornell and Syracuse, they're both great. Like, I got everything I wanted out of them. But I will say, like, as humbly as possible, it's a little bit messed up to me that Syracuse and Cornell can post on whatever they want that I went there and that I'm an alum, and they can use that as an ad. But there's a possibility that if I wear a Syracuse shirt on my podcast and I make money off of it, that they could come for me. That's disappointing, well, right? Like, there's that possibility that it's like, hey, that doesn't seem great. And I love my schools. That's something across all NCAA, but interesting.
I had an interesting conversation today, and it was with a guy who used to work at the NFL, and he made the comment that he told David Stern something. And I'll start the story with him telling David Stern, because David Stern was a colossus of a figure as NBA commissioner, and nobody could tell him much because at the end of his career, he was sort of a tyrant too. But he was brilliant. And if you, in the United States, we look at him as maybe the guy who made basketball everything you'd like it to be. And at Europe, he saved basketball and brought it to the world. So, but Stern figured out, even after being angry about it, that there were certain uses of school property that, or and not in his case, school property, but NBA property that he needed to do that would expand the brand. And then there were certain uses where he said, no, we don't want to give you this. And I'll never forget, he was confronted with YouTube and highlights in this way. And he said, you know, if we put all of our highlights up on YouTube, people will, for lack of a better word, Google them and look them up, and they'll see players. And no one's gonna buy Wilt Chamberlain's four best games or buy Bill Russell's four best games in a collection. I can't monetize it there, but on YouTube I can monetize it and keep it current. So I might as well put up the past in those circumstances. So I think one of the things that schools were not very, and in a lot of cases, because they've licensed out their media marketing partners, their marks. And they were, the Marx companies were afraid of doing business with them. They didn't really figure out what I should give to my athletes, what I should prohibit from my athletes, how I get a happy medium to what I'll let them do on social media for themselves, what I won't let them do for a money-making opportunity, which is just crazy. And if they had done a better job in that area, they could really have much more brand, they could have much more brand reach than they have right now. And that's one of the things you have to think about, what NIL could be versus what it currently is. It should be hyper brand extension for schools. And that should be what they're looking for. They haven't figured that out yet. Well, I have to win a national championship. Well, you probably aren't. And you have to, or I have to win, make the final. Well, you're probably not gonna. So I don't want to pick on Rutgers, but they had two top 10 draft picks and didn't even make the tournament in men's basketball. You can't bank success. You can bank reach.
Yeah, it's true. Like, we spend so much time on the top 1%, right? But all the rest of the people, you know, in the top 10 still have a massive following. They still are interesting, and they're still better at their sport than the fans at home. Like, why aren't we tapping into that, right? I think that's all interesting. With that said, I kind of want to bring the topic into what's going on for student athletes here. And I think there's a lot of different ways where in some ways they're being taken advantage of, or they're not given the full information. That is the basis for my podcast, from the sports business angle that I take of my show, is I have great conversations with people in the industry all the time. I'm going to share it with you guys as much as I can. I'm not going to tell you trade secrets, but this is how things work. This is how your college athletic department is organized. If you have a question, this is the person that you should ask. If they say they don't know, well, this is the person you should ask. That's what I do. And one thing I have found is there's a lot of people entering this space who consider themselves experts because they were college athletes, right? Oh, I was a college athlete in the 90s, in the early 2000s. I want to help athletes. And they see all of this opportunity for NIL, opportunity for agents, all of this, and they come and join. The amount of NIL agents I've met in the last few years with no representation experience is very interesting to me. And I just wonder, as great as it is to have someone who understands the experience and maybe feels for these athletes, in some ways, are we doing them a disservice? Like, right? Like, how do we manage this growing industry and make sure that it's good? So with you being an agent and your experience, I'm really interested to see from you, like, what you think on this.
I try not to ever use the A word, agent. I do this as a lawyer, and I do it when it's appropriate. I don't solicit clients, and I certainly don't go out and look for this in the space, but it's something that everybody does. And I was earlier in my life a player representative for professional athletes. So recovering is the best way. But I do think, if you think about it, one of the problems of the system is we try to cut off athletes from representation. We do it paternalistically. We're playing sort of into the NCAA's hands or the institution's hands, that it's about the bad agent. It's not, or Congress's hands now. It's about the bad representation. It's not about the misconduct. And I'll come back to the Matt Sluka case is probably the best one on that one. Is all the sleight of hand was the fact that he had matriculated from Holy Cross to Boston to UNLV. He'd moved across the country, started the first three games, and whatever happened, whether he was not going to be the starter after that, whether there was a miscommunication about how much he was going to get, whatever happened, is all we heard about is that he had an agent who wasn't certified in Utah or Nevada or whatever state, and the deal was a problem. Now, he's never sued, so we don't know where he's going to go on that one. But ultimately, I do think that it's easy to place the blame on somebody who isn't us every time, and we see that. So I think the thing, again, comes back to education. You don't want to be represented by somebody who is plying his trade to get you. You want to be represented by somebody who understands and will take you on as a client, but will also educate you along the way. So I think the idea that athletes can get representation was one of the key features of NIL, that it opened the door to all that, because that had been closed off too. And I really kind of resent the attempts by regulators to cut that off, because it's only going to drive up the cost of it, the advice in it. What the athlete has to understand in that process is how much and how valuable their own services are, how much value their time is, and they have to choose accordingly, as opposed to the other way around. So don't take promises. Don't jump into this space. Take this very carefully, and you'll know who to choose. One of the problems is athletes are very rarely alone in this system. They have parents, they have brothers and sisters, and they have a lot of people who are also trying to make some money off them too. And so sometimes this really becomes complicated. But no, I think there are opportunities. But again, I think if you treat it this way and say, look, I'm looking for legal advice. I'm not looking to have my life managed. I want the best possible contract. And the best possible contract is always this, the shortest, with the least exclusivity. And then you could decide, I want a longer contract, and I want a longer contract. Because I will tell you, the best contract stories in the history of the world, back to Donald Dell and our prior story, is Donald Dell did a deal with Adidas to get Stan Smith, who was the number one tennis player in the world, in 1972's name onto a shoe. The shoe already existed. Adidas was making it with a German player's name, Robert Hallett. But they took his name off, put Stan Smith's name on, and that shoe still sells. 50 odd years later. So, and it's one of the best selling shoes. So it's interesting to think about that, is how do I build long-term relationships, high levels of trust and high levels of commitment in a world where everybody's pitching me. And I think that's one of the things that athletes need to think about and need to be as careful about that as they were about their college choice.
Yeah. But who trusts with this education and passing this information on? I mean, you have lots of experts out there that obviously claim they're experts and they're not. Then you have the NCAA, who is trying to obviously influence towards their direction. You have universities and colleges that are trying to influence athletes to go in their direction. So who do you trust? Who do you get the best education from?
Trust Sydney.
Let's talk about it.com. That's funny.
Trust her. I trust the people who aren't making any money off telling you what they think the truth is. You could trust the people at your school probably next, because they don't want to see horror stories. And then if you can create some trusted advisors, people that you know have your back in these moments, you'll be able to build that network. What you don't want to do is you don't want to create a community of people that's all interested only in the next deal of yours, and they want to see, and if they talk about you as a person, that's probably the most important part. Hey, what's this going to be about you? What do you want to do? In fact, that would be the first question I'd probably ask anybody who came to me about a prospective NIL deal. What's valuable to you?
Yeah, 100%. It's going to take time. And I think that's why you're saying the best deal is the short deal, 100%.
Well, at least the first go around, yeah.
From a first agent, I'm playing professional volleyball. My first thing, my main thing, no go, was we're doing a 1-year contract. And I actually started off asking for 3-month contract. I was like, I want a 3-month contract so that at the end of the summer, if I don't like you, I can move on. And I didn't miss out on a whole season because I didn't have a great agent or I didn't get a good team, right?
And Sydney, let me ask you a couple questions just from that. You probably had a pretty good idea. What were the things that would have been, I like you at the end of that 3 months or end of the year? If we were to look back at this relationship a year from now, what would be signs it was a good one?
Communication. I am someone we talked about on the last episode. I'm an anxious person. So I want to have that communication. I want to know relatively what you're doing and how things are going. I want a realistic conversation. When I ask you, hey, you've seen me play, about how much do you think I could get for my salary going abroad? Or what did the team say? If they said no, I don't want to hear they thought that you were good. I want to know, oh, this other, the person that they took had, that honesty, the person they took had better stats, they had a lower price, blah, 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 blah. They didn't think you were a good fit because of this. And then I would say the final is some form of success and results. Another thing we talked about last episode success to me doesn't always necessarily mean 100% we hit our goal, but were we active in getting to the steps? And have you shown me the steps it would take to potentially reach that goal? Sometimes the contract's not there, especially in professional sports, but are you an agent or a trusted source that is actually doing the things that could potentially get me there? And that takes time. And it took, those things were things from my mom, who was a professional athlete and had an agent, knew. I had friends and advisors and coaches who told me, hey, these are the things to look out for. But those kinds of things, knowing who I am.
And it doesn't mean necessarily that maybe Sydney and I didn't have a perfect relationship or don't have a perfect fit or perfect chemistry. Doesn't mean we're bad. Just means that I didn't want to give her the information that she wanted in the moment or what she needed. So the fact that breakups are sort of normal and inevitable, we want to keep the economic consequences of those as low as possible, is probably the best way to think about it. Also, by the same token, recognizing that the longer you're with somebody, the better the relationship tends to be and the more favorable you get status in that relationship. If you're the first big client of somebody, you're gonna have that. If you're even a small client of somebody along the way, there's a lot of value in being early. So don't reject people that don't have a lot of experience, but talk about the service, talk about those hallmarks as Sydney just laid out. That's priceless stuff in a lot of ways. And even for somebody who hasn't imagined this, probably go think what would be authentic to yourself to make this a good experience in a year, and know what you can't control. You can't control success on the court or on the field. You can't control torn ACLs. You can't control a lot of things, but what are the known control items that you would be able to do? If I was there for them when they were injured, that I didn't drop their, if I took their call when they were hurt, if I was able to help them to think about what was next, those would all be big things for me in this process.
Yeah, I say too, I feel like I've heard from a lot of different people that the agent experience doesn't always work. If you're someone like me and you put a lot of time and effort, you're writing your notes right now and you're going through these calls and you're doing your best to decide and it still doesn't quite work out, doesn't necessarily mean there's a fault with you. You just make your best decision with what you can at the time and you make a slightly better decision next time. I feel like we're talking a lot right now about those big athletes, right? Like, I don't even actually have an agent at the moment. I have an agent to play professionally. I don't have an agent for my NIL deals or any of that. So this is interesting, though, because it creates a dynamic in the locker room that I'm very intrigued by. You already have, every team has the person that's the star athlete. That's just better. Every team has an athlete that seems like is coach's kid. Like, every coach loves this kid. They can do no wrong in coach's eyes. And every team has someone who's maybe more popular, more charismatic, more interesting on campus. What do you do when that person now is driving up to class with a G-Wagon or a Maserati, right? We already have assumptions about athletes on campus, especially in the big Power 4, Power 5 schools, where athletes get special treatment, athletes have this and that, we deserve these resources. Now when you have your friends or your classmates' salary getting posted on Forbes, right? Or you have people who are very obviously have more resources, more attention than you, both in the locker room and just on campus. But how does that affect a school? When the House versus NCAA case settlement was approved, I was looking at the comments, and it's people that are major college football fans, like, I'm canceling my season tickets. I'm not paying, you know, $2,000, $3,000 a year to buy this 18-year-old a Maserati. Or all these different things. It's affecting the thing. There's laws in Congress about you can't use student activity fees to pay student athletes or to add to the athletic budget. There's conflicts happening in student senates and in school senates and board of trustees and all this about this topic. Like, Bob, working at PSU, now working at a law school, like, what does this look like to you? I feel like you've probably seen years of these dynamics. Like, that's a lot that I brought up, but I'm excited.
Well, now, Bob, what is the conversation between you and your peers, not only at Shoemaker, Kendrick, and Loop, but also at Seton Hall Law and just in the sports industry in general?
I try not to talk about this with people. My God, I might get mad. No, because Cindy said this. Look, I started representing football players because I was working at the University of Tennessee, and I saw all these like guys with fancy cars. and money that was coming out of their own pockets that their agents had gotten for them back in the early 90s before the draft. And I realized, wait a second, isn't the guy idea that we keep the money in the player's pocket to help them prepare for a future that's uncertain, that might only last a couple of years? That was part of my reason for wanting to represent players, that I got to see this up close and personally. Should we not focus on what's the most important part of the play is? I think one of the challenges, obviously, of any college team today is the wage gap, if you will, the wealth gap between certain sports, certain athletes in certain sports and certain circumstances, and the pressure that comes with that. The idea that if I pay you through a collective, if I bet on you, I get to say terrible stuff to you. I get to run you down as a human. I get to criticize you in a special way, which is hard on young people. I mean, it's hard on professional athletes, but they tend to figure that out as they go and are exposed to it more. But I think we're putting a lot more pressure on young people in this moment. I don't think they should be denied the benefit of what they deserve and what they can work for. I mean, I think Livy Dunn is probably the perfect example who's made $3 or $4 million a year at one catalog shoot at a time. You know, 300,000 catalog shoots to get there, that she's worked her tail off to get there. And that might be too dramatic a phrase, but no one's probably worked harder to get there than she has, and managing her followers. I don't think football players have necessarily done the same thing, and so that they haven't gotten benefit from that. So it's been money given to that they expected and that they've probably frittered away and not managed carefully. Or if they managed it carefully, that was a wonderful thing. But I don't think we've talked about those things, what money's effect on one's life is, how it changes or inverts your values, and how it can invert your values. So I'm really important on the idea that, like, look, there's a reason why, you know, we bankruptcy is at about 35% for professional athletes, that divorces run above 50% for professional athletes at retirement, that living in poverty and bad things happen because you lose your identity, and that this inevitable transition comes. So I think if you can start thinking about the minute your college career is ending or as your college career is beginning, you're on borrowed time already. You're on borrowed time from an injury, a talent gap, something. And I think if you're too frivolous, too flashy, then it really isn't helping anybody. And I think it plays into that kind of, I don't like certain people getting certain things, which is unfortunately we have as Americans, right? Whereas I'd like to see people, hey, I you almost have to treat it in this way. And I don't like the Yankees, but I'll talk about a guy who wore fame and wealth better than almost anybody else. I'll talk about Derek Jeter for a second. And I think Derek Jeter might be a jerk, but he would never let the Yankee fans know it while he was playing. It was always about the team. It was always about what was best. It was always about the value of the pinstripes, the championship, the things that he did. He never said the wrong word for a second. And I'm sure that made Alex Rodriguez, who played next to him, absolutely crazy, because Alex was like, he's not nearly as good as I am. And look at him, and he's making almost as much. And so I think the idea, if you can be a team, you have to be able to blend those ideas. But it's hard on the collegiate level. It's really hard amongst young people. And to some degree, I'd like to see it be less of a factor while you're playing. It's always going to be a factor, but it needs to be a bit less of a factor for college players.
Sydney, as the resident NIL expert, as we close out this episode, what do you have to share with our listeners, whether they're collegiate athletes, coaches, athletic directors, fans, or anyone else just looking from the outside or actually looking from the inside into NIL? What would your closing thoughts be for them?
I think for the athletes directly, like, everyone's path journey needs are different, right? Even if you're coming in on a scholarship, a full team of full, everyone's on scholarship, everyone has a different home life and different needs, right? So I think cataloging your needs, understanding what's available, what should be available, and going that way is the standard. Whether you're in revenue share, negotiation for contracts, whether you're revenue share contract negotiations, whether you're determining what school that you're going to commit to, whether you're a woman athlete and you're deciding, hey, am I gonna join in on this lawsuit? I think really understanding where you truly are and what you actually need is great. There's a hierarchy of needs in this situation that I think is really important. You don't want to get so wrapped up in maybe other people's problems at the moment that you're forgetting what's actually really important to you. Don't start, you know, negotiating and getting mad and voting for things to get paid $1 million when you're still reusing KT tape. Ask for that KT tape first, and then we can worry about the budget, because all the money is
going to... tape? Come on, you're lucky.
Like the fact that we even have it is amazing. Yeah, you're right. And so I think just in understanding that, I think if everyone does that and really is level set and understanding of like what is actually happening, where they are, and you're decently open with the person next to you about that, I think we could get to a much better situation. But when we only have certain things going up in the media and certain people being really fiery and not everyone truly understanding what's happening, I think that's really what's causing the problem with NIL. Look at yourself in the mirror. Like, you want NIL rights. Do you want to be famous? Do you want 100,000 girls following you on Instagram and DMing you every day, and you feel a responsibility to respond to them, and you feel the need to post every week and show who you are? Or do you want free coffee? It is okay to just want a free coffee, but you have to be real with yourself and really check out your needs and move from there.
Sydney, that's brilliant advice. And people like you are actually making the difference, because you're a trusted source, because you're able to tell this to people in a way that is, again, authentic to your own experience and theirs. And it's not so far separated that you've lived through these iterations. Complicated scheme and world, but proud to spend some time with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. I loved hearing your perspective. I didn't realize all that about your background. All these calls we've been on, we're always talking about other topics. We're not talking about your history. So I loved like being able to, we all have history, but I loved hearing more about your work experience and everything that goes into what you talk about. So thank you so much for coming on the show. That's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
We hope this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance and impact of leadership and organizational culture.
This episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast was produced by Sydney Moore and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki. Music by Chase Griffin.
If you'd like to learn more about culture and sports, the Culture and Sports Podcast, or our other programs, go to cultureandsports.com, where there's a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses.
Or you can connect with us on all social media platforms @Culture and Sports. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports Podcast.